League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Oasis Podcast, Episode 3, All Around the World. A talk tonight with Casey Bennett.
Tony McCarroll and Ginger Baker of Burnage on such Oasis classics as Live Forever, Supersonic and Shaker Maker. Now, for the first time ever on brown vinyl, Strawn & Lard Enterprises proudly present Tony McCarroll's Classical Gas. Your 100 best tunes performed by the BBC Philharmonic, embellished with the distinctive kick-botty McCarroll drumming. The Four Seasons never sounded this good. Eric Sarti's Gymnopedy. A bit on the tentative side? Not anymore. What about Prokofiev's Montagues and Catapults, pepped up with the McCarroll Thunderstick treatment? To get a copy of this album, ring 0500 110 100 and ask for Bonehead. Tony McCarroll and the BBC Philharmonic, cooking on classical gas. And remember, this album is not available in the shops, because it's f***ing rubbish. It's a bit of your head out of me. To go through all the things I want to be. I don't believe in everything I see. You know I'm blind, so why do you disagree? So take me.
Casey, how are you doing?
Good. Thank you for having me on, James.
Well, you are more than welcome. It's great to have you on, and thank you for being our first guest and our first international guest, which is very cool, and hence the title of this one. We're going with All Around the World, because you are in Albuquerque, right?
I am. Albuquerque, New Mexico, United States of America.
Which is all the way around the world, pretty much.
Exactly. How fitting. I love it.
So my top three things about Albuquerque, okay, because I have been doing my research.
Awesome.
Number one, your state anthem or your city anthem is Prefab Sprout, King of Rock and Roll.
Is it now? You see, you're laying knowledge on me.
So, do you not know that song?
No, I don't.
Hot dog, jumping frog, Albuquerque. No?
No, I feel like such a bad New Mexican. I don't even know that song.
Okay, I'm going to definitely play. I did send it to you by email about 5 minutes before we started recording.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, there was a Scottish band in the 80s or early 90s, and they did this song called King of Rock and Roll, and the chorus basically just says Albuquerque in it, and that is how, if you say Albuquerque to most British people, that's what they'd know of as Albuquerque. Yeah.
Oh, how funny. Obviously here it's become, you know, Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
Yeah, and
so you are basically the meth capital of America, yeah?
Yeah, if TV's to be believed, certainly. And that's fine. As long as it puts us in association with that wonderful show, I'll take it. And then, of course, Looney Tunes becomes the other kind of mainstay. Bugs Bunny would frequently say, you know, take a ride at Albuquerque. So
yes.
Because clearly it was just the most hilarious city they could find to reference in a cartoon. So, you know, fair play. Love it.
See, you know, I knew I should have made a left turn at Albuquerque. Don't look much like Los Angeles to me. I knew I should have taken that left turn at Albuquerque.
Well, the other one is the Shins are from Albuquerque, right?
It's true, yeah. In fact, I mean, I'm friends with a guy that I lived with them for a while and dated one of their sisters, and so I've even got connections two, three steps removed from them. But yeah, totally, this is their place. And in fact, here's another tidbit I seldom think about, which is I went to the same high school as Freddie Prinze Jr. and Neil Patrick Harris.
There we go. On my research, I saw those. They were Albuquerqueans. Is that what you call it?
They certainly were. They went to La Cueva High School, just like me. And another high school here, Highland High School, is what Mike Judge based the location of the Beavis and Butthead series off of. That high school in the cartoon is called Highland. So yeah, there you go.
That is pretty impressive. All for that one place.
I suppose so.
So the Movie Multiverse podcast is how we got to know each other through emails and things. But, I mean, what made you go and start a podcast?
Oh, well, you know, I'm a working man. I 9-to-5 it. I'm a graphic designer, so I spend a lot of time pushing pixels, just sitting in front of a computer, and a lot of tasks I end up doing are, you know, just somewhat mundane, and I like to have something running in my ears. And so I got very attached to podcasts, and at a point I thought to myself, man, I'd love to be doing something like this. I would hear sort of the good time and the rapport that a lot of people doing podcasts had, and I thought to myself, well, I feel like I have that sort of I don't know. I feel like I at least have up to this quality type of conversation with, say, my best friend Joel, who at the time, and still does, lived in L.A., California. And I thought to myself, well, I mean, you know, I could just call him up, like I always do, to discuss whatever awesome new movie I just saw. And instead of it just being that, I can press record on a device and then put it out to other people. Obviously, it became a little more. I put some structure to it and all that, but that was the basis of it, and I thought it sounded like fun. And yeah, that was a few years ago, and we've been going ever since.
I remember because Kevin Smith is obviously the Podfather, right?
Is
one of my, you know, one of the first people I got into in podcasting, and he always said, you just do it, right? And also, it's those conversations that you have with your friends. I mean, I wish that I'd had, you know, we just pressed record on those, it's just dumb nights where you sit around talking rubbish with each other.
Exactly.
And that's some of the best times. And you just think, oh, if only, you know, sometimes someone will remind me, oh, remember this, that night when we were saying this. And you think, oh, if we'd recorded that, that'd be amazing. And so I think, yeah, it's those conversations that you would have had anyway. But just hit record, if you find it interesting, then probably other people will find it interesting too.
Exactly, and I suppose there has to be a bit of ego to it, of like, well, I think there's people out there that would like listening to me. But I mean, I don't think my co-host Joel or I are particularly egotistic in that way. If nothing else, I think, and we've mentioned this on the podcast before, it helps ensure. It puts a schedule to our conversations, and it makes sure that we stay in touch because life can get very busy with families and work and all that. So we at least every couple of weeks get on the horn and talk to each other, even if it's about some silly comic book movie. But of course, you know, we end up talking about other things before and after. So, you know, it's nice. It very much keeps me connected with my best friend. And clearly some other people have found some enjoyment out of it. And so it's really just, it's all good. It's a good time.
I mean, that's my favorite thing about your show is that, yeah, that you really get the feel for the fact that you guys have a really good relationship and work together very well. And that's the main thing, isn't it? You know, that like the other one, and the reason I got onto you guys was the Weekly Planet podcast, which which is once again two really good friends just talking to each other, and yeah, they could be, yeah, you call it, you listen in because you're interested in hearing about the subject that they're talking about, but really it's the relationship between the two people that really makes a big
difference. It's fun hearing the rapport, yeah, the funny moments, all that kind of stuff. It's great.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so yeah, I mean, we're here today to talk about the Thor Ragnarok trailer, right? Oh man, so excited. No, I'm just kidding, obviously.
Different hats
on,
mate.
That's all I'm used to talking about when I get in front of the mic.
I know. But, well, today we're mainly going to be talking about music, and we're mainly going to be talking about Oasis. I mean, but so you growing up, I mean, I get the impression that you're a musician, you're a drummer. Well, I suppose some would argue those two things aren't necessarily the same. But
like Noel Gallagher would say something like that, I believe. In fact, I believe in Supersonic, he referred to drummers as smelly, useless, talentless losers. I made note of that.
Yep. Yeah, that little clip might be coming in now.
Drummers are really smelly, useless, talentless losers, man. I mean, in fact, having a job where you bang things all day. That's like orangutans do that, don't they? And gorillas and monkeys and that. They just bang things, like bang dustbin lids on their heads and all that. That's what they do, isn't it? And drummers just do it and get paid loads of money for it. Fucking sack them all, drum machines, I'm saying, man. I'm telling you, can't wait till I'm in a dance band. Press the button.
Yeah, I got a kick out of that because, I mean, we'll talk more about it, but sort of how the Gallagher brothers viewed the other members of the bands, and specifically like the drummer's seat, you know?
Yes. Yeah. Spinal Tap comes to mind.
Oh, goodness. Just a revolving door. Yeah, it's funny. Some bands are just like that, you know?
Your first drummer was
the Peeper.
John Stumpy Peeps.
Oh, yeah.
Great, great. Tall, blonde geek with glasses.
Yeah. Good drummer.
Great look, good drummer,
fine drummer. What happened to him?
He died. He died in a bizarre gardening accident some years back.
It's really one of those things. It was, you know, the authorities said, you know, best leave it unsolved, really, you know.
And he was replaced by
Stumpy Joe.
Eric Stumpy Eric Joe.
Child.
Yeah. And what happened to Stumpy Joe?
Well, it's not a very pleasant story, but he died. He choked on the official explanation was he choked on vomit.
You see some bands where clearly they've all just been friends ever since the beginning, and they couldn't imagine anyone else filling the role. And then there's some bands where it's like, yeah, well, I mean, us two main guys are really the, you know, we're the stars. We're the only important piece. So exactly. The other ones, who cares? You know.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a brilliant bit. I don't know if there's a great bit of studio recording that you've got of the Beatles in the Let It Be sessions, where George Harrison walks out. He just gets up. He's sick of it. He gets up and says, like, "I'll be leaving the band now," and he just walks out. And Lennon then just turns around and goes, "All right, see you, George. Let's get Eric. Let's just get Eric in. That's fine. Right, he's gone. Yeah. We'll just get Eric Clapton." It's like, that's George Harrison, man. You can't just get Eric Clapton in. You know, that's key component. Yeah, but yeah. Beatles, no. Sorry, Oasis, Bonehead's gone. Fine, get someone else, you know. But, but yeah, I mean, you know, obviously what you're known for, if as I say, as an internet personality, is talking about TV and movies. Mm-hmm. But really, music is a big part of your life, I take it.
Yeah, it certainly is. I mean, even more so when I was younger, that very same gentleman that I do the podcast with, Joel, we were in, you know, several iterations of bands back in the day. And, you know, we probably got the most traction and, I don't know, recognition to an extent out of a band called Flood the Sun. And we did a bit of a tour. We did a couple of small albums. We played a lot here in Albuquerque. It's not as if we ever got up to any sort of level like the Shins. You know, nobody listening to this will have likely heard of us, but we had a good time. It was a lot of fun. It was born of our love of music in general. And it was pretty hard. It was pretty punk, I'd say. Very fast. It never really let up. And I'll, you know, I'm not even entirely sure if you've heard us. Likely not. You'd have to do some real digging online, but I'll certainly send you some files.
I listened to some more Mowod stuff.
Yeah.
Well, firstly, because obviously it's the music you use in the podcast, and and the fact that it's called the Mowods, right? So you think, well, that's mod, and I'm the king of the mods, so we've got to you got to check that out. But
yeah, and you know those guys are great. Joel's not a member of that band anymore, but you know he really enjoyed his time with them. I think playing saxophone, because I mean he's kind of a multi-instrument guy. He sings guitar, he can do bass if it comes to it, he can play, you know, drums, and saxophone is what he rocked in that band. And they were just kind of a very dive bar kind of grungy melodic thing, and I dig them.
Cool. So what music were you into growing up then? Was it mainly more the punk stuff or the British stuff as well?
So I was a bit of a latecomer to music, but certainly late middle school and then into high school, it became a very big part of my life. And yeah, I'd say punk and just rock in general, but really, I mean, especially it being the 90s, alternative was big for me. And then, of course, you know, I'd say Oasis broke into that and, you know, very much became a part of that type of thing, and what someone would follow then would know and appreciate, somewhere between, you know, the pop and alternative. But specifically, British, Britpop, that kind of thing was never so much my thing. But of course, the kind of stuff that broke through, that came from across the pond, like Radiohead and Oasis, and you know, sometimes it became sort of nebulous. Every once in a while, I would find out a band was British, and I go, "Oh, I wasn't even aware," because it would just be one of those bands I was just kind of into. So that certainly specifically wasn't the thing. Of course, Oasis became this thing in the 90s, and these hits would break through, Wonderwall, and Live Forever and this and that, and of course, I gravitated towards those. I was like, oh wow, these are solid, these are really great. And you know, it's become apparent, especially in the, you know, sort of bit of, you know, research. And like I said, I watched most of that documentary, Supersonic, that I got to tell you, I just wasn't aware of what a gigantic phenomenon Oasis was. Yes. In the UK and really other parts of the world. I saw how they like went to Japan and were mobbed in the streets and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
but in the US, it was a little bit more downplayed, a little more subtle. Mm. They just sort of were, you know, they'd pop up on, I don't know, TRL or something, and it'd be like, oh, you know, these guys are great. This is their new hit, huh? Nice. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't like people were going nuts, Beatles style, you know, in arenas. Right. and that kind of thing. So, yeah, that was really fascinating for me to find out, because I always had an appreciation for them, like really, and they would always find a way onto, like, mixtapes and stuff that I was making, because, you know, how can you not love them? They just had an amazing sound, you know?
It was just insane here. I mean, when they broke through, I mean, definitely maybe became the fastest selling album of all time, a debut album
right.
of all time. And at the time, they'd only had the three singles out, so they had Live Forever out, had just cracked the top 10. But
well, that's what was particularly fascinating to me, yeah. was that they didn't even have an album out, like, when people were already getting crazy for them. Like, they had singles that had made it out, and they were like, yeah, but the album's coming, and people were already excited about, like, the first full-length album of, you know, of a band like that. And it's like, wow, now that's, like, a level of like, really superstardom right there.
Well, I think the difference was, as well, is that the B-sides were incredible. So you straight away, you would buy the singles. But then on the B, so the first single, Supersonic, has this incredible ballad on it, Take Me Away.
It's clean and the good times are growing, so take me away just for today, cause I'm sad here on my own. I'd like to be under the sea, but I probably need a phone.
So if you've bought this, there's this new indie band out, or check this single out, and then you carry on listening to track two, and it's this really lovely little ballad sung by a completely different guy. And you think, what? You know, this isn't the sort of garage band that did the first song. So,
right.
And that was the big thing. That was a really big thing, was that the CD singles. And if you look at like the record sales around the time, Oasis singles were just constantly in the charts for years, just because you had to have them, because it wasn't just like, oh, most bands, you buy the album, and if you really love them, you'll buy the singles, but the B-sides might be okay, there, you know, might be a live track or an alternate version or something. Well, the Oasis songs,
they just had to fill the space.
Exactly. With Oasis, I mean, The Master Plan was never a single, and it was never an album track. It was only, you know, there's Acquiesce, all these songs that were like probably get into people's top 10 Oasis songs, most of them were B-sides. And and Noel's talk later about the fact he was a bit stupid with that he should have really filled the albums properly, but they just sort of threw them up there as and when he wrote them, rather than actually holding them back for albums. Because, you know, you've got, like, on Be Here Now, for instance, the best example is, there's a B-side, I don't know if you know it, called Let's All Make Believe, which I don't know if you've ever heard that song.
I don't believe I have.
I'll ping it over. It's a B-side to Go Let It Out. And the Standing on the Shoulder of Giants albums, you know, a decent album, but there's a couple of sort of dodgy tracks that, it probably could have been B-sides, like I Can See a Liar and Where Your Money, you know, Put Your Money Where Your Mouth Is. Whereas then there's this absolutely brilliant, heartfelt, powerful song, clearly about, like, a breakup of a relationship. It might be about the brothers themselves.
We're still friends and we like each other. Let's all make believe. In the end, we'll need each other. Let's all make believe that all mankind's gonna feed our brother. Let's all make believe that in the end we all grow. We'll be right back.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
And Liam's vocal is maybe his, one of his greatest ever vocals, and yet it was just thrown up on a B-side, you know. And you think, why was that? You know, that would have been the slideaway of that album,
right.
You know.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's funny.
Wow. Yeah, that's crazy interesting. I mean, but that, like you say, that's where they started from, and it's like, well, if something like this is so quality, well, geez, what are they going to do with a full album? And you know, obviously they were blowing people away with everything they released for a time there, so it's just really impressive.
Yeah, and so you're saying well, especially in Albuquerque, it didn't really, you know, it was just another band that you'd hear on the radio, another band. It wasn't a big sort of impact of them kind of arriving on the scene, so to speak.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure if early to mid 90s if my finger was super on the pulse, but no, I mean, I was even seeing those clips where it was like they'd be on a show like Letterman and he'd say, they're the biggest band in the UK, here's Oasis, and that's kind of how they were known. It's like, oh, well, that's interesting. I guess we should pay attention if they're the biggest band somewhere. And so obviously their singles got a lot of play. I remember hearing Wonderwall a lot, and I really fell in love with that song back in the day. But yeah, everything that it's interesting because everything that came through, I totally loved and would be like, oh, great, man, this new Oasis song is great. And yet, for some reason, for the niche, whether it leaned a little more grunge or punk that I was really focusing on at the time, never inspired me to really seek out those albums and listen to them, you know, front to back. So it wasn't until later, until I heard a lot more of the sort of lesser known, at least to Americans, tracks, and just discovered that, yeah, they were just a solid kind of, there's no fluff, there's no garbage, you know, sort of filling in between the singles. Like, they just produced really good music, you know, front to back, yeah.
Yeah, especially on this first, especially the first three. I mean, I know Be Here Now gets, in some quarters, Be Here Now gets slagged off a bit, but you know, I think most Oasis fans, that's either their favorite or one of their favorites, because that is that's really the encapsulation of everything they did. That is the bombacity and the over the topness of the, you know, that became in that mid to late 90s period, really.
Sure. Well, that almost, yeah, feels like the 90s were really their time, their heyday, because they continued on and had, what was it, three more albums in the 2000s?
Yeah, four, I think. What have we got?
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, Standing on the Shoulder, Heathen Chemistry, Dig Out Your Soul, and Don't Believe the Truth. Yeah, yeah.
Right, four. Which not nearly as much, you know, attention. It would be hard to say I've heard a handful of tracks.
You've got like Stop Crying Your Heart Out. I know you've meant that was a pretty big song.
The good point. I do love
Hindu,
that one.
Hindu Times and Lila, I don't know if they made it through, but they were pretty big singles over here.
Oh, really? Yeah. No, yeah. I'm not even sure if I've actually heard those. So yeah, it's pretty interesting. Okay. Much more familiar with the 90s era.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that is, I mean, most people are. And even the, you know, that's the thing, even on Twitter, so, you know, I've been running these polls, and so far we've done the, you know, pick your, you know, let's build the ultimate Oasis album. And so far, the first three that we've done, the definitely maybe track 1, 2, and 3 has won every single time.
It's almost as if, is the perfect Oasis album just definitely gonna be maybe? Definitely maybe.
I know. Well, we'll see, because the next one is track 4, and that's Up in the Sky, Don't Look Back in Anger. I can't remember off the Be Here Now one is off the top of my head. I think maybe, I hope, I think I know. So, and
well,
then the later
one.
Yeah, so
yeah,
I think maybe
money,
Don't Look Back in Anger might
back.
Be
yeah,
Up in
exactly.
the Sky. But you never know. We do love Definitely Maybe over here. So, So that's great. So, what, I mean, as an American, I mean, a lot of English people struggle to understand what the Gallagher brothers are saying, especially Liam. I mean, do you even have a clue what they're saying? Did you have to watch Supersonic with subtitles on?
Well, I don't know if it's just, you know, I I downloaded it, and the majority of, I mean, especially when they were talking, just had subtitles, which I was so glad for, because, yeah, I mean, I hardly understand what they're saying, which is so funny, because one of the more appealing or, at least just specific things about their music, I always thought, was how all the lyrics are always so clear and, like, articulate. Yeah. And, like, they really, enunciate. Liam does the majority of what you're hearing, and you just kind of know the lyrics to an Oasis song. Whereas when you just see them talking, it's like, what is happening? Yeah. I'm only catching maybe half of these words.
What is going on in this room now? Can walk next door to boys' home, yeah? Go in there and be like, hey, fuck. Oh, Jesus Christ, this fucking, we've got to get this fucking thing together now, because, like, it's not in time. And, like, if it's not in time, this fucking mean you're going, like, hey. You go in there, Dave, and it's like, well, hey, come on, hey. Like, we come in this room, and it's like, you know, it's the funny farm. And that's what it's all about. It's like, do what you frigging want. If you want to go, like, that, do it, because it don't mean nothing. If you want to go, do that. If you want to go, hey, fuck, man. Like, hey, fuck, like, do that. But if you want to just do this, what I'm doing here now, just do it, like, because it's like, right?
This is an advert for not taking drugs.
No, this is an advert. This is an advert.
It's not getting into chemical abuse big time.
Hey, people who know that I have not been a fucking, I've never been an abuser. No one's, I've never been an abuser, I've been a user. I've never been an abuser, man. And they know, they do drugs, they do the air, man, the air, man. And
I mean, I don't want there to be anything derogatory about that. Obviously, you're acknowledging that that's a thing even in the UK.
Yeah.
And what is that really is that a Manchester thing, or what is that a result of?
Yeah, well, that's Manchester, and it's more that, you know, especially Liam, you know, they're working class guys, right? And so, so when working, I mean, it's funny when I hear Americans talk, they sort of tend to say middle class. That you know, most people say, oh, well, we're lower middle class, and that meant you were kind of grow up poor. No, middle class here means you're an accountant or a solicitor or a dentist or something. Uh-huh. And it's working classes, you work in a factory and they did grow up, as you see from, you know, as you obviously know, it's, they grew up pretty poor in a council estate, you know, which was the sort of government provided housing. And you know, you find, especially in the north of England, people in certain areas with very, very strong accents, like Newcastle, you know, in the northeast, has got that particular Geordie accent that's very difficult to understand. Or, you know, and you just, they do have, although geographically, you know, they're actually pretty close. Like Manchester and Liverpool is only, I think, 20, 30 miles between them. And yet the accents and the culture and everything in those two towns is just completely different.
Right.
And so it's just bizarre that you can just literally drive 20 miles and hear a completely different accent in the
really
north of England.
Is. That's fascinating.
Yeah, but it's not just your American ears there. They are pretty hard to understand. I think that's one of the things that people really loved about them, because, you know, at the time, if you think about, you know, the big music in the most successful music at the time. I mean, as you were saying, it was called alternative music, but they ended up becoming, or we call it indie, that they ended up being an indie band, in inverted commas, that were the biggest band in the country. So, well, they're no longer indie, really, because they're the biggest and the best. But you didn't really hear, I mean, the Stone Roses had been huge over here, but not broken through to that extent. You know, the Stone Roses had been the most revered band when they came out with their debut album, and they had a similar style and attitude, and a lot of Oasis comes from that Stone Roses sort of swagger and style of talking, and you know, you can really see that, especially in the early Liam and the way he behaved. It was very, very much modeled on the Stone Roses. But other than them, who had, you know, hadn't really broken through to the mainstream, the big act in the early 90s here were your sort of hangovers from the 80s. It was your Phil Collins and Elton John and people like that. And really, the Oasis mission statement was, let's get rid of these people. You know, we want to be the biggest selling. And indie bands at the time you had people like Ned's Atomic Dustbin and Carter the Unstoppable Sex Machine and people like that who were, you know, pretty content to sell out, you know, 100 tickets in Camden in North London and sell 5,000 copies of their album, and that would be, you know, a breakthrough. They'd be the biggest band.
Uh-huh.
I'm completely, I'm going to be destroyed in the comments on this, but because that's not the case, but I'm exaggerating. Whereas Oasis just had that sort of desire to be bigger than that.
Oh, and well, good. So, I mean, they certainly don't seem to have any lack of confidence in the footage I've seen. Like, they were determined to and were sure that they were the best band in the world. And and then that just was, like, they were. And that's pretty amazing. I mean, they're incredibly unique. The more I listen to them, especially lately, the more I think I just can't really compare them directly with, you know, any other band. And what's interesting to me, I mean, you were even talking about like the distance between Manchester and Liverpool, and it started to remind me of the fact that, like, is there an intentional, I don't know, did they ever claim to be inspired, like, specifically by the Beatles?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, all the way through. And you know, I'll do an episode just on the Oasis and Beatles connections.
Mm-hmm,
you know, there's things like, there's all the way through. You've got, they're deliberately referencing Beatles lyrics.
Sure.
Whether it be, you know, and do you know what I mean? He says, like, "Fool on the Hill" and "I Feel Fine," and it's like, okay, that's just direct. You know, sing a song for me, one from Let It Be. Yeah, there's peppered all the way through. Peppered. There you go. Peppered all the way through is. You know, is directly influenced the lyrics, and is just what Noel tended to do. I mean, Noel wasn't a big music geek, really. You know, he would have a lot of best ofs. I mean, that's what he says. He wasn't really a big guy going into you know, really deep into back catalogs and alternative mixes and stuff. He was into best ofs, and so while people sort of, you know, would pick on the Beatles because, you know, that's, they had the haircuts and they referenced the Beatles and they wanted to be the biggest band since the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
Really, it's people like Slade. You know, there's a I don't know if you're aware of Slade, really, if they really made it over there. Slade were a Birmingham band in the 70s that had incredible songs, and their sort of back catalogue of singles, I don't think they ever really did anything over there. Their biggest song was
"Merry
Christmas, Everybody." So here it is, Merry Christmas. That was their biggest song. But they did, you know, Oasis sound is probably closer to Slade than it is to the Beatles.
Yeah.
And who else? And like T-Rex, you know, and people like that. Obviously, Cigarettes and Alcohol just directly rips off Get It On by T-Rex. And so yeah, so while the Beatles was definitely an influence in the music, and they covered "I Am the Walrus," you know, on their they always used to end their shows with "I Am the Walrus."
Okay. Nice, nice.
That was their first, you know, and that was actually what Alan McGee, when he signed them in that, you know, that fateful night in King Tut's Wah Wah Hut in Glasgow, was you know, he was pretty amazed by them. But then for a Manchester band to have the confidence to play a version of "I'm the Walrus" that's just like a punk, stripped down, balls to the wall, you know, no messing around with sound effects or anything, just going for it, and then having this like crazy sort of 2 or 3 minutes guitar solo at the end. And this is, they were supporting, right? You know, they're a support band that shouldn't have even been on the bill anyway. And then they get up and they strut around like they own the place, and then do finish with this like ridiculously long version of I'm the Walrus. And obviously, right, you can imagine at the venue, they look at their watches like, okay, one more song, all right, fine. And then they play this like 8 minute long version of I'm the Walrus. And it's like, oh, and actually in my band, we kind of did a similar thing. It wasn't a cover, but we ended our sets with a song called A Lesser Part of Nothing. And it would have like a, you know, like a Layla by Derek and the Dominoes, Eric Clapton. Yeah. And, you know, that Layla has that long outro. Or it's more like, I suppose, I'm the Resurrection by the Stone Roses. So the actual song would be about 3 minutes long. And then it would kind of stop and then come back in with like a 3 minute guitar solo. And so whenever they were like, okay, one more song, guys, come on, one more song, we go, yep, look at each other, like nod and wink, yeah, here, yeah, we go,
we know which one.
Yeah, 8 minutes later, yeah, okay, that's, we'll good, get off now. But I, nice, mean, I was completely influenced by that, by just the arrogance of Oasis, and it's that, oh, yeah, that boldness of being, yeah, we're the best band. And so I would just strut around, and you know, I would wear a t-shirt that said like, follow that. And I'd like take off what I was wearing on top, and like, you know, stand, go and walk over to the stage where the next band on was, let him point at my follow that t-shirt and give him a nod, yeah, like, yeah, yeah, follow that, man. So yeah.
Well, I mean, clearly there was an element of that lent to their success, because I mean, they just it felt like they were unstoppable, and they knew it, and that's so interesting. And I'm kind of embarrassed, you know, not being an Uber fan and of Oasis, although I would say I love Oasis and being your first guest, but I, you know, I feel like at least I'm bringing the token American perspective. And if nothing else, it's allowing you to sort of bring a bit of a primer on the band and some tidbits about them to the table. So I'm really appreciative, and I got to say, I'm loving this podcast and the thought behind it, and especially the sense of community it already seems to be attracting already.
Yeah, well, that's important, I think. And it is, I mean, there's some great kind of, for Oasis fans, there's great fora, I suppose, to go to, like the Reddit, the r/Oasis is great. Mm-hmm. You know, that's really good. And just on Twitter, I mean, if people listening do follow us, follow on Twitter at Oasis Podcast. Say, I've been running these polls, it's just good fun, and interacting with people, and there's, you know, it is, they still have this impact. People still want to go back to them and share images and share video, and especially over here, they're still a tabloid concern. You know, they will still, they do something, it's a big deal, you know, right. Like Liam, as I was saying in the last one, Liam's going to be, you know, second on the bill at Reading and Leeds Festival, which is our sort of second biggest festival over here after Glastonbury. So, you know, that's massive.
Well, yeah, I mean, they have a timeless quality to them. And although there's tracks that I'll listen to and it'll bring me back to the 90s, just sort of in a nostalgic kind of way, I enjoy it no less. In fact, in a lot of cases, even more listening to them now, because it's just good quality music. You know, I would compare them, you know, very much to the Beatles in that kind of way. It's like, it doesn't feel dated in a way where it's like, this isn't the style of music I want to be hearing right now. It just is good, and it continues to be so, you know?
Yeah. So we were talking about your favorite song, and I was expecting, with your sort of punk background, I was thinking it was going to be something like Head Shrinker or Bring It On Down, some of these sort of really... Right. Early, definitely maybe B-sides that have got that just stripped down rock sound to them.
Well,
and
yeah,
I was quite surprised to hear your choice.
I find myself discovering those now, which is great, but that's not, like I was saying, that's not the kind of stuff that broke through, so it wasn't really the kind of stuff I was more familiar with.
Okay. And your favorite song is?
All Around the World.
Which is crazy to me. Yeah, that's mad. I mean, can you remember, did that make a big splash when that came out over there?
Here's the thing. It was certainly a single that, you know, became, yeah, it played on the radio here and people were aware of it. And yeah, it was a hit and all that. But for me specifically, I've got to say I had, so it's a bit of an odd story to recount, but I would, you know, I was in high school and I would stay up, you know, all hours, and I would keep the TV on and I would want to see music videos. I loved music videos. And yet this was a time where on MTV here, they were actually becoming, you know, less and less common to show up on MTV, the music videos. They were being replaced with all these reality shows and competition shows and this and that. And even TRL would be more people talking about the videos than them actually being on there. And so late at night is where you'd be able to see them. They just have these huge chunks of video after video after video. And one night when I was just, you know, glued to my screen, just, you know, I just want to watch a few more. That one came on and it was the first time I'd heard the song. And so, and I don't know if I was semi-delirious or what, but it almost felt like I don't want to exaggerate, but like, I don't know, like an out-of-body experience watching that video. It was just really incredible to me because it was the first time I'd heard the song. And obviously, if, you know, if you recall that video, it's just got a lot of kind of trippy visuals, not even all that trippy, just, you know, it made me think of a lot of things like, you know, Beatles and Monty Python. It's just got those kind of, definitely, you know, random, absolutely, you know, animated elements that, you know, everything feels like it's kind of making a statement and it's all just that very simple animation. But it was just going from scene to scene and it was all brightly colored and I was like, this is amazing. And it blew me away. It really did. And it, like, it almost brought me to tears. But the song itself, if you can imagine my sort of semi-delusional state, and you've mentioned this, I think, in our preliminary talks, is just how it builds and builds and just gets bigger and bigger. And like, key changes and more layers and horns and whatever else. And that it just felt epic, you know? Yeah.
Especially in that video as well, when, you know, there's a huge kind of... at the end, it goes up and up and up, and that sort of the little thing that had started like a tiny little ship has grown into this huge like monster
exactly.
ship.
And then, visually, the same thing is happening as the building of the music itself.
And there's like an egg on the top, isn't it? And then it opens up, and there's Knowles to the very top, like playing like and doing his na na na. And then
it's genius. It's fascinating.
The perfect encapsulation. If a music video is there to encapsulate a song.
Right,
I think that's
exactly.
The perfect music video.
And it made it feel like such this big anthem, and I was blown away. And so ever since then, it's had this real impact on me, and so I'll listen to it to get pumped up, and it just keeps going. Every time you think it's about to end, it steps it up one more time, and it's so exciting. And so I was really interested in you, like right away when I had told you that, you sent me that clip of them playing it like before they'd even gotten their big break. Like that was one of their seemingly like earliest things that they would jam on. Mm. And I was like, oh, that's so cool. And they just held it in reserve until they could like just blow us away with the crazy production value and epicness of it. So cool.
That it's mad that, so in, and I'll drop it in here. So they were rehearsing it all the way back into 1992 when Noel had just joined the band.
Mm-hmm.
And there's that brilliant footage of them in the rehearsal rooms in Boardwalk playing it. But yeah, they knew they wanted a 128-piece orchestra. Now, what little indie band of people are on the dole, which is, you know what on the dole means?
No.
So on the dole means you haven't got a job, unemployment support or unemployment benefit.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So that's... Yeah, so these guys in Manchester, with no money, no real opportunity, they're probably just going to have, especially Liam, like probably just going to be like a life of crime, you know. There's not he didn't really have any hope of doing anything. And yet, and they're sit there planning on, oh yeah, well, we won't release this song because we'll wait until we can afford a 128-piece orchestra on it, you know.
Which they seemed to have no doubt in their mind was just on the horizon. It was just a matter of when, you know.
Absolutely, yeah.
But from such humble beginnings, that's still just incredible to imagine them just assuming that. It's so funny.
Yeah, so no, I love it. And I also love the fact that, talking about the Beatles, you know, you have the 8-minute song, which is a pretty long song anyway, and then it goes. Then the album goes to another track. I think it's Getting Better Man, and then you think, well, that wasn't quite enough. The 8 minutes. Let's have another couple of minutes as well at the end. So then you have the All Around the World reprise comes back in at the very end of the album. It's like, oh yeah, you really need an extra 2 minutes of that, don't you? It's just
Well, I mean, they were finally doing it. They're going to do it right. They're going to hit it hard.
So really, for me, it's the encapsulation of that album. You know, and just that that time where they'd done Nebworth in 1996, the biggest shows that any band in the UK had ever done. They had reached this peak of this is the biggest thing that's happened in the UK since the Beatles. You know, there's no doubt about it. And then they go into the studio with this ridiculous level of confidence, knowing, okay, what are we going to do now? And some bands would have, you know, maybe stripped it back. You know, like Blur. With their Blur album, you know, with Song 2 which is the album with Song 2, they went the other way. They were listening to like lo-fi, like American stuff, like Fugazi and people like that. And Graham Coxon tried to unlearn how to play the guitar, and they had the other reaction. They went back that way, whereas Oasis just went, no, we're gonna if What's the Story, Morning Glory was sort of 10 out of 10, we're going 100 out of 10, and we're just going completely over the top. And that, with an 8-minute song with all the na-na-nas and everything, was the perfect kind of summation of that.
Sure.
And then it's then from there, really, that then the kind of, once they got the backlash to Be Here Now, that, oh, hold on, this wasn't necessarily what people wanted. You know, this has gone a bit too far.
Sure, sure. But it just felt like such a statement. It was so impactful. And me being in a place that didn't like really put up on a pedestal everything they were releasing, it felt almost a little personal to me, because like I said, that single didn't catch on like crazy, like Wonderwall level or anything. So in a way, maybe it's my semi punk rock sensibilities where I was like, well, this isn't as big. This feels like my favorite song because I haven't heard it played to death on the radio. Whereas, of course, I love, you know, so many of the songs that broke through in that way on the radio here. But in a way, it's like, you know, slightly burnt out on them. Whereas that one felt almost a little more personal to me. I probably wouldn't have had that same experience if I'd lived in England, you know. So it was just interesting.
No, that's great. Good. The only other thing I was going to say on that really is that then, so they did play that live quite a few, you know, that was then the linchpin of that tour in sort of 97, 98. And then I think they just got rid of it. I think they dropped it from the set, and they kind of dropped a lot of Be Here Now from the set, from the live set, just because it was sort of, you know, and Noel now, I think that on the first episode I dropped this in. So, you know, Noel talks about the fact that he really doesn't like the album. You know, he thinks he looks back at it and it is overblown and it's too long and it's too overproduced. Yeah. But I think that's the charm of it. And they did a recent, last year they remixed, Noel did a remix of Do You Know What I Mean? And he kind of stripped it back and it made it sound like a Noel Gallagher High Flying Birds song, you know, one of his solo songs. And I was like, no, this is the point of this album. Once you start stripping away all the layers and all the crazy over the top,
own it.
That's, you know, you're taking away what made the song special. You know, you've got to do that. And that for me was what was so great about that. But then when they get into their Standing on the Shoulders of Giants, which was the next album, they did then start sort of experimenting with kind of loops and different sounds and different instruments. And they just stripped things back a lot. And that was a good album, and it was important, I think, to try and do something a bit different. But then I think they sort of realized that people don't really like that. They want us to be Oasis, you know. They want us to stick to what they did best, and then so the next two albums after that were sort of going back to the more stripped down, basic right. Oasis sound.
Which served them well. It makes sense that they would do that.
Yeah. The only other thing I was, how are you doing for time, Casey? You okay?
Oh, I'm fine. Yeah, I mean, late, you know me. We go long on the movie Multiverse, so I'm down for whatever you want to do.
That's fine. So the other thing I was going to talk to you about was, as with your background as a drummer, was the drumming, the different drummers Oasis
sure.
have had.
Yeah.
And I pinged you some bits over. So did you have any thoughts on those?
Yeah, you know, I checked that stuff out and I tried to pay attention to as I was sort of listening to back catalog, the albums. I was trying to focus on that kind of stuff. And I am a drummer, and I certainly don't want to play too much into Noel's perception of drummers. but you know, I'm not a super musician, and I'm not I'm certainly not overly judgmental. I like to find, I don't know, the best in things that I'm reviewing or looking at it in a critical way. And really, Oasis, I think, is a great example of a band, and I mean, I think the Beatles, people say this of them a lot, that there's not it's not overly complicated. They're not the most technical band in the world. Of course, they're amazing musicians. Well, yeah. Well, I mean, but that's the thing. That's the beauty of a lot of bands that get, like, real big mass appeal, is that the simplicity really plays to just, you know, your ability to super enjoy, and they hit on something that's universal. I mean, something can be catchy and really melodic, but not, you know, break the mold as far as, you know, musicality. And there's nothing wrong with that. So I think the drummer role in almost all of their tracks is a great indication of that, because there's not difficult things happening, and yet it's always solid. And you know, watching what I did of the documentary, it was, you know, poor Tony. Seeing his trajectory was sad to me, because clearly where they were going with their music, they seemed to think he was lacking. And yet, you know, he was hitting the marks, doing what needed to be done, and keeping a beat, at least from what we were hearing on the recordings. And maybe that was a struggle, because if a drummer isn't providing that backbone and keeping things in time, yeah, that can be a pain in the ass. So, you know, I could totally see why maybe they would drop him if that was the case.
And also with Tony McCarroll, I don't think people give credit for is how iconic, you know, the intro to Live Forever and the intro to Slide Away. There are quite a few Oasis songs from that period that have gone down as like classics that start with the drums, and it's whether it's his playing or whether it's like the production of the drums. You know, you couldn't, you know, without Live Forever, that sort of that is so iconic. And you know, straight away you hear that and it hits you and you think, oh wow, what is this? You know, and it was and so I think that he deserves a lot of credit for that, really.
Absolutely. And I mean, but it's not difficult, but it's gotta be solid. And I feel like he always met that requirement, at least in any recordings I ever heard. And for a track to start with drums, it's gotta grab you. And I think those certainly do. And it's like, okay, where are we going with this? Come on, come on. And then everything else comes in and it's like, oh yeah, that works just right. Good for you. So yeah, I certainly appreciated him as a drummer. By the way, I can't recall if I've cursed in this. Are you trying to keep a non-explicit on these?
No, you can feel free.
Okay, sounds good. So yeah, you know, I mean, I dug him, and clearly he didn't last a super long time. In fact, he'd only be on the first album, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so then when you get into the others, I mean, like I said, I'm the least familiar with the later years, so it'd be hard to speak about the other guys. But Alan White for Morning Glory, it seemed like he was doing a great job. I mean, even a step up from Tony. So I definitely feel like they traded up, and Clearly, like we've talked about, they never saw any problem with, you know, like fine-tuning a car or something, just replacing out a part if it's going to do all the better. Although there was that interesting line that I feel like Noel said, where he was like, and he started to talk to me about drums, and I said, I don't care, as long as you lick the part, it'll do. And I thought that was funny, and sometimes I'm not entirely sure if, like, when they say things like that, if they're semi-kidding.
Yeah, it's
almost
as if it's
part of the
It's that Mancunian kind of, sarcastic sort of...
Right.
Yeah, and it's that working class, like, piss. Everything's a piss take,
everything's taking the piss out of whatever's being discussed. Right, it's very funny. But obviously they want someone who's actually bringing the quality to their instrument. And I feel like he totally did. You know, I dig totally what he did on Morning Glory. That track in particular, by the way, I also love. That's very
the Morning Glory song.
For me.
And Wonderwall. I think the Wonderwall is probably my favorite example of that. And James, drop this in here.
I don't believe that anybody feels the way I do about you now. To lead us there are blinding. There are many things that I would like to say to you, but I don't know how.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
So that was the Isolated, just Liam's voice and the drums. And Tony could not have done that. You know,
so interesting that they said that, and that very well may be true. And if that's the case, then, you know, it's true. That guy's not going to last, like, with where they wanted to go musically. So, you know, as sad as it is to see how that kind of thing goes, obviously it's for the best.
I think it was great. And Alan White worked out very well in the band. Just to give a brief bit of history on it, so he left briefly in 2001 and was replaced by his brother Steve White, who was the was mostly famous for having played with Paul Weller. And there's a couple of really good bits. There's a documentary of they did a tour with the Black Crowes in 2001 called the Brotherly Love Tour. And Steve White was actually, if you read up on it, a lot of people say that tour with Steve White's drumming, because Steve is a phenomenal drummer, that was maybe the strongest ever Oasis lineup, with Steve White on drums.
Interesting.
And he was, you know, and I'll drop in here.
Why did Mitch Mitchell play like that and
John Bonham did in the early days, but he was like, what it is, it's really boring. The reason it's played like that, this is probably the best way to play the drums, right? But the reason that drummers play like that is because it all comes from the military. And the side drum would have been on the side, like, of your shoulder, and it's hard to play like that. So they developed it playing like that. And it really comes down to who taught you. Because some drummers, and a lot of those drummers, like Mitch Mitchell, were taught probably older jazz drummers. Right. So they would have been shown like that, but just kept it.
There you go, rock school for today, children.
There you go, I told you, it was nothing radical.
Drum workshop.
Episode 2. I'll piss off the rest of the band.
Well, he's talking about the different styles of drumming, and they talk about in this documentary Noel's asking him about why certain drummers hold their sticks like that, I won't be able to put this in the podcast. Someone's hold their sticks like you'd hold your knife and fork, whereas some of them would hold it more within their hand.
Where they sort of flip, the back of their hand down, and that's called traditional style. Yeah.
Oh, okay. And so Steve explains it in this clip that it's more if you come from a military background, because that was they would play the side drum. And so that
because
was
it would be turned, so it made more sense to hold your left the stick that's in your left hand, sort of your hand upside down compared to the other.
And that's quite interesting. But in this clip, they so Noel asks Steve the question, and Steve's like, I could tell you, but it's really boring. and he's like, no, go on. So he explains it, and then he's like, yeah, you were really bored, weren't you? And they're all sort of saying, that was boring.
Pretty much.
but no, I think that's... So the interesting thing there is then that it was always a case of the band came first, you know, and so, and then so Alan White then sort of into having played on then Standing on the Shoulders and on Heathen Chemistry, he then sort of wanted to spend some time with his girlfriend or something like that. So he's like, okay, fine, get out, we'll get someone else in. But what's quite interesting after that is that they then had Zach Starkey, Ringo Starr's son, come in, which is probably the most direct Beatles comparison you can have. Son of Ringo comes in. But he was never officially a band member. So it was Oasis became a four-man band at that time, and he was just the hired help, really. He was never officially the drummer. And he... because he was sharing duties with The Who.
The Incredible Zach Starkey!
He plays. He still to this day plays drums for The Who.
Yeah, and I saw a bit of those clips.
And he's really good for The Who. The problem with The Who they've had ever since Keith Moon died is it is impossible to replace Keith Moon, right?
Of course, no one's ever gonna be that. Yeah.
No. So that was the, and I remember that at the time, sort of it always being an issue with, well, Oasis are going to try and tour, but they can't because Zach Starkey's off with The Who at the moment. So it was, it feels like he's never really committed and sat and stayed with one band. He has always tended to sort of, just do the jobs,
float around
between the two. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. But then I think Zach's style was just much more, whereas Alan was maybe a little bit more nuanced and would try and do different things. I think Zach was then more down to, in keeping with the fact that with those albums, they tended to just get back more to the classic Oasis sound. Zach was just a bit more straightforward, a bit more kind of 4/4 beat and just bash it out, really.
Yeah. Well, and then, of course, and I didn't even mention it. I mean, to tie in two of the things we were talking about, of course, Alan played on All Around the World for
yes.
in Be Here Absolutely. Now. So, I mean, I appreciate a lot of what he did there. I mean, it takes, you have to be a certain, level of drummer to be able to have the dynamics to really build in the way that kind of song does and hang with it. And then, a lot of the things that he does towards the end for, building feels second to get to get second to get to get second to get second to get to get second, all that kind of stuff. I really, love. So to be able to hang with that and add to the, we're doing this is really great. So I appreciated him a lot. Yeah. And so, like I said, beyond that, I don't think I can really comment a lot on the other guys other than to say that I think Oasis absolutely required a level of skill beyond poor Tony at a point to really excel and be a really important part of that band. And yet, I don't think anything hugely over the top or difficult or anything like that was asked of an Oasis drummer. Although I'm sure you've seen more live footage than me. I'm sure some awesome drum solos could have been laid down here and there.
Well, they never really, did drum solos as such. I mean, the only real drum solo is on the track The Shock of the Lightning from their last album, Dig Out Your Soul.
Oh.
And so Zach Starkey was replaced in 2008 with Chris Sharrock, who was in a band called the Icicle Works, and then he was also in the Lightning Seeds for a while, who were a great 90s Britpop band. And then he was also then Robbie Williams' drummer.
Interesting.
And,
okay.
Yeah, and so Oasis had Liam had this massive sort of public bust up with Robbie Williams, and and so it was really kind of a point of contention. Right, we're going to steal your drummer, mate.
So interesting.
So they actually just stole his drummer, right? Really, mainly just to piss off Robbie Williams.
Right.
And he is a phenomenal drummer, and and the drum solo on "Shock of the Lightning" really demonstrates that. And once again, reading online in preparation for today, it feels like that maybe Chris Sharrock. The sad thing was he never recorded with the band because he just did that final kind of world tour. But then, that drum solo and that tour really showed that this guy's a very special drummer. And if they'd gone on to record, then maybe that would have he could have done a lot more with them. But yeah.
But I mean, obviously, like we're saying, the focus was never, I don't think was ever allowed to be taken too far off of the Gallagher brothers, because they were the beating heart of that band, clearly.
Yeah.
What with the double punch of an amazing songwriter and just an incredible frontman, like Liam's vocals, like, just still blow me away to hear them, like, and especially to hear that story of how that wasn't even really a thing for him, and then at a point he just started in, like, post whatever, getting hit in the head with a hammer, and he's just, it's so unique, it's so clean, it's a really awesome voice, and that's what's always, I think that's what's always generally, brought me into the sound of the band, is that I don't think any voice is really what Liam's voice is as a frontman, and I even appreciate Noel's vocals and all that, but it's like just listening to Wonderwall, it's like, oh, this is so clean and smooth, and I could listen to this on repeat all day,
it's perfect. And I think that's for me, this is my kind of big takeaway on Oasis and what kind of why the later albums weren't as good, is that what made Oasis, right, as you said, a brilliant songwriter and a brilliant singer. So what you want is the songwriter writing the songs and the singer singing those songs.
So that obviously started to blur,
right? That makes sense. If you've got the best songwriter and the best singer, you put the two together. Whereas from and then so definitely maybe there's a real lack of Noel. You can hardly hear Noel singing at all. It's really either, Liam's doing a lot of the backing vocals, and I think Liam as a backing vocalist is great. His timbre or whatever of his voice as a backing vocalist, I think, is brilliant. And it's a real shame that sort of fell away in later albums, that Noel did all the backing vocals. And then when you get into What's the Story, then Noel does Don't Look Back in Anger, and I think that kind of emboldened him to do more songs. And then so as you go through the albums, there's less and less that Liam is singing, and there's less that Noel is writing. And I think by the time you get to the last couple of albums, there's only actually three songs that are that perfect combination of Noel wrote them and Liam sings them, because Gem's writing and Andy's writing and Liam's writing, and those songs, I mean, there are a couple of good ones. There's some songs that Liam wrote and Gem wrote and Andy wrote that are good Oasis songs, but they feel like an Oasis tribute band. It doesn't feel like the core. It does feel like a step, and that's what they were, because Andy and Gem were writing, thinking, oh, I'm writing a song for Oasis, and so it feels like an Oasis tribute band is what it feels like, if an Oasis tribute band were going to go and record their own original album, and so the last couple of albums, that you can pretty much pick the best songs, and it's the ones that Noel wrote and Liam sang. And And you just think, well, why? And
because that's the machine. That's the beautiful exactly. chemistry. Yeah. That's how it worked. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And going back to what we're saying about the musicianship and replacing people. You know, that was what, sort of taking it back to kind of where we started this conversation. That was what really emboldened us as a band and emboldened a lot of people around the country, and there was a massive spike in guitar sales in the mid-90s after Oasis broke, was that, you know, most bands you'd see, like you look at like a Metallica or a Guns N' Roses or someone like that, and their level of playing and musicianship between them, you think, as a 15-year-old, you think, I'm not going to be that. I can't. I'm not going to be Slash. You know, I'm not going to be Lars Ulrich on the drums.
Exactly.
But you see, look at Gwigsy, Bonehead, Tony McCarroll. They were pretty average players, all of them. You know,
right.
Liam's
even
Liam
their
wasn't
names a, make you feel like you can at least rise to that level.
Exactly. Yeah, and they, you know, and they weren't. So you would see these guys that just looked like. I mean, Liam always looked like a superstar.
Yeah,
but you know,
yeah.
they were just wearing, you know, street clothes. They were just lads, you know, that you would see on the street.
Right.
Liam, you know, Liam didn't do anything. You know, he would just stand still, but it was just the attitude. So as we were, you know, as sort of seeing this band, and this is for me personally, and then I'm sure thousands of people around the country, you just think, I could do that.
Right. And inspired a generation.
You know?
Sure.
And Noel's songs, you know, they are very, very simple. You know, you can, and most of them are just played with open chords. And, you know, and even Noel's sort of as lead guitar, I mean, he's not even really a lead guitar player, and he's admitted as much. He doesn't do remarkable things. I mean, I'll drop
right.
in here. It plays actually over the closing credits of Supersonic, and it's at Nebworth. They play Champagne Supernova,
uh-huh.
and John Squire from the Stone Roses, who's an incredible guitarist, comes mm-hmm. on and plays with them. And suddenly
okay.
you hear, oh, okay, that's a lead guitar.
right.
But you know, but you didn't need that. You didn't need all that over
sure.
the top musicianship.
No,
and that really,
it wasn't their sound, and that's
no.
fine. You know, because
yeah.
what they did was solid. You know.
Yeah. And that was what was so inspiring, I think, because you did think I could do this. You know.
Sure. Exactly. Even
to.
Though it's not, yeah, overly complicated. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And
I
just
do.
The,
I do love Champagne Supernova.
Yeah. Well, I think. That's a perfect segue to finish it, because you mentioned that one of your favorite artists is Ben Folds, right?
It's true. Yeah, my favorite, I would say.
Okay, and Ben Folds is a big Oasis fan, and he did a live version of Champagne Supernova.
Is that so true? Oh, shame on me for not knowing that. That's awesome.
Well, there you go. Well, I'll. So I think we'll finish the show with that. But Casey, thank you so much for your time today. I really do really appreciate it.
Absolutely, I was happy to be on, and I'm glad you asked me to. It was a great talk, and who knows, maybe sometime down the line I can check back in.
Absolutely. And do you want to just tell people how to find you and tell them about the movie Multiverse again?
Oh, of course. You know, you can search iTunes for the Movie Multiverse podcast. You can just search that, Movie Multiverse, and if you're into superhero, comic book type movies, just nerdy genre stuff in that way. We cover some television shows as well. Then I would hope you'd appreciate what we've got to put out there. And we're on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, all of that, at Movie Multiverse. You could always email me if you were so inclined at moviemultiverse@gmail.com. We always appreciate feedback, and yeah, we love people to check us out, and reviews are always welcome.
Wonderful. Casey, that's great. I'll speak to you soon.
Excellent. Thanks, James. Take care.
We're walking down the hall faster than a cannonball. Where were you when we were in high? Find me, don't believe the landslide.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there. League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.